Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Beal. Dr. Beal is a past president of ARSC and a twice second VP program chair. He joined ARSC in 1971, and in the 42 years since then has missed only two conferences. A lifelong record collector, he brought that into his studies, writing a PhD dissertation on early broadcast recordings. A native of New York and New Jersey, he is now retired from teaching media in Kentucky. His daughter Leah has taken up his collecting interests, much to the chagrin of her mother, and this is assisting today on the PowerPoint, making sure that Dad has not gotten any of the slides in upside down. His paper is titled, From Laughter to Tragedy 50 Years Ago, The Two Most Unusual Christmas Record Seasons. Let's welcome Mike Beal.
Out of the way.
How about if it, can it go under here?
No, it has to go under the table. She's using it.
Oh, you're looking at it.
I'm running.
Oh, I did not know
that. The Christmas holiday season is important for all retail industries, and the record business is or was and no exception. Not only are expectations high that gift giving would provide hefty sales for regular records, but there were always the special Christmas season records that were actually only generally available during the Christmas season. Stores would get delivery of them around Thanksgiving, and if they wanted credit for unsold copies, they must be returned to the distributor by around January 15th. They were treated as a special inventory category. And every year, a few major performers would have a Christmas album release that they had recorded in the heat of July. There were perennials, of course, albums and singles that returned to the stores and sales charts that one special time of the year, like White Christmas. Novelty records were also important, but more as singles. The tradition goes back, way back, to Christmas Morning at Clancy's, or Ernie Hare's 1922, Santa Claus Hides in the Phonograph. Now there's trauma for you. All I want for Christmas is my two front teeth, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Frosty the Snowman, I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, and then the Chipmunk Song. But the important thing to remember about all these novelty songs is they were about Christmas or the winter season. But then came the Christmas season of 1962, which was literally hijacked by two comedy albums, which knocked everything off the charts. And they had nothing to do with Christmas. One was even Jewish-tinged, but had nothing to do with Hanukkah. These two albums sold faster than any other albums in history, and still 50 years later, you find copies of them in every garage sale and rummage store. And I found one at Half Price Books, this is 2 days ago. 50 years, 1962. It's hard for me to believe it was 50 years ago. I was 16 years old and already an avid record collector, but still just learning about the industry. These albums, Alan Sherman's My Son the Folk Singer, and especially Vaughn Meader and Booker Dowd's The First Family, taught me a lot. But to top it off, the very next year, 1963, the record industry was again hijacked by an album, and then a whole phalanx of albums, related by tragedy to The First Family, the assassination the week before Thanksgiving of President Kennedy. Alan Sherman had been knocking around show business since the early 1950s, but not as a performer. He invented one of my favorite TV shows, I've Got a Secret, but was eased out because his ideas were getting a little too zany. Moving out to the coast, he was very popular with many show business people, and as shy as he was, he could always be counted on to sing some hilarious song parodies at parties. One thing led to another, and Warner Brothers Records decided to add him to their growing stable of comedy record performers. My Son the Doctor, or My Son the Lawyer, were proud introductions Jewish mothers dreamed of giving. But My Son the Song Parodist? Oy vey. But Warner Brothers soon realized that paying for the rights to satirize current songs might be expensive for an experiment like this, when they had to shelve his parodies of the Warner Brothers movie My Fair Lady. So they had him work over songs that they figured were in the public domain. Folk songs. Of course, they got sued by the publishers of Waterboy. Oy vey. The First Family did not have its genesis as most people think. It was not initiated as a vehicle for Vaughn Meader. He came in the middle of the project. Bob Booker and Earl Dowd were two aspiring radio DJs and comedy writers. Early in 1962, they conceived of a comedy album that would treat the young, handsome president and his family in typical American family situations, coupled with the obvious fact that this was no ordinary family. They were working on the script in mid-July when they happened to catch a CBS summer replacement show, Celebrity Talent Scouts. Amazingly, I also caught that same show. Celebrities brought out new professional talent they had discovered. It was not amateur hour. I happened to have a kinescope film recording of that very episode. It was in my first batch of films that I found in a garage sale around the corner, even before I had a 16mm projector. But alas, of course, someone cut out Vaughn Meader's debut out of the print. But recently, Bob Booker released the audio of that performance, and it tells a lot about the style of Vaughn Meader. He was not just a Kennedy imitator. That was a small part of his act. Even in his TV debut performance, it was only one part of four parts in his 8-minute act. And it was 4 minutes into that piece before he suddenly drops into his Kennedy imitation. Notice the surprise of the audience, who has never heard anything like this before. I've edited this down quite a bit, making a couple of the edits obvious so you know where it's edited. The host, Jim Backus, was his sponsor.
Delighted with the TV debut of Mr. Vaughn Meader. Thank you. There must be some mistake. I'm not really a comedian. You see, I'm a collector. And right now, I'm very busy collecting, famous political quotations is what I'm working on now. For instance, I'm sure you all know the famous one from Senator Bill Forgets of Arizona, who was quoted as saying, "My immigration bill would permit more foreign neighbors to visit our shores and at the same time keep out the alien element." Here's one that might be a little more familiar to you. Congressman Reed Wright of Alabama was quoted as saying, "Literacy test ain't proven nothing." So it looked pretty good. The president's doing a fine job. One of his highlights came last month. He got the steel companies to rescind their price increases. And his prestige went way up. His prestige went so high that now he's asked the steel companies to try to raise their prices again this month. He needs all the help. What will politicians be doing, say, 60 years from now? I think I could show you best what they'll be doing in the year 2022 by presenting a newscast 60 years from now.
Good evening. This is Huntley Brinkley, Cronkite Jr., with the latest news. Word from Hollywood, a brand new motion picture coming out next week, Cleopatra. And now this station would like to take the opportunity to wish the President of the United States a very happy 67th birthday. Happy birthday, President Caroline Kennedy.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very kindly. You're probably wondering by now why I talk so much about politics. Well, a certain politician has had a great effect on my life. Let me show you what I mean.
Listen to the audience.
You see, I used to be your top nightclub comedian. But for the past... For the past 3 years, there's somebody going around this country impersonating me. Now, I didn't mind around the New England area. I didn't mind around the Washington, D.C. area, but now it's gone just a little bit too far. It wouldn't be so bad if this were just another guy. This is not just another guy. This fellow is also an entertainer. He's doing my act. He's doing my gestures. And he's using my lines. Do not ask what this country can do for you. That's one of my original lines. And now he's a big TV star. He's got his own program. He calls it Press Conference. It's like the old radio show, Can You Top This? Let me give you an example on that.
Could you comment on the African situation, please?
Well, I'm not up to date on that. Now, I sent a personal representative to Africa some months ago, and so far she hasn't even dropped me a card. No, not you, Miss McClendon, the gentleman in back of you.
Sir, when are we going to send a man to the moon?
Whenever Mr. Goldwater wants to go, I will think that. Yes.
Sir, do you have any final comments?
Yes, I'd like to make one final statement at this time. And I would like to make that final statement as myself, Von Meter. And that is to say thank you to the United States, a country where it is possible for a young comedian like myself to come out on television before millions of people and kid its leading citizen. Thank you. Good night.
Ending in his own voice shows that from the very beginning he realized that he did not want to be trapped into being known only as a JFK imitator. But he was too brilliant at it to escape at least the public thinking that that's all he was. It's hard to now realize that imitating political figures for comedy purposes was just not done in 1962. Sure, there were political comedians like Shelley Berman, Mort Saul, Professor Irwin Corey, Lenny Bruce, and Dick Gregory, but they didn't do imitations. Mimics like Will Jordan, Sammy Davis Jr., Rich Little, and all the others did imitations of show business personalities. Ike? Anyone imitate Ike? Kirk Douglas, Mae West, Ed Sullivan? Yes, of course. But Truman? How about Estes Kefauver? John Foster Dulles? The only one I could think of from that era was Joe McCarthy, first in the Canadian drama The Investigator, and then in Stan Freberg's Point of Order. Yes, there had been imitations of FDR and Churchill, but never in a comedy. And near the beginning of FDR's administration, the White House sent out a letter to broadcasters that they would appreciate it if they stopped doing FDR imitations on shows like The March of Time. They said they did trust those producers, but what if someone for some nefarious reason went on the air imitating FDR about the bank crisis, or later on the war? Same with Churchill. But who knew the voices of the others? Neville Chamberlain? There were some physical parodies, like George M. Cohan strutting around in I'd Rather Be Right in a way that the paralyzed FDR couldn't. And ironically, Cohan himself was only physically imitated by James Cagney. Cagney never got the voice. In a Life magazine article, besides Meter, their idea of JFK imitators were Peter Lynn Hayes and Mary Healy, and Gordon and Sheila McRae. Booker and Dowd knew this and realized that their album would break new ground if JFK remained popular long enough and if they could find an imitator. And poof, a pop Von Meter. They went to see him at the club he was playing in New York, got him interested, and signed him to a one-and-one contract. He would do a second album if the first one sold. And they ended up nearly having to sue him to get that second album done. They needed a Jackie and auditioned probably every woman in New York before finding Naomi Brossett, a model and semi-professional actress. Most people didn't notice that these and the two other Kennedy brothers were the only imitations on the album. Every other voice was just a comedic voice. Instead of taking scale, Meter was forced into taking a piece of the action to make sure he would do the second album if they needed him. Dowd's friend Chuck McCann put up the money for a demo recording, and Booker and Dowd shopped it around. Something like 12 companies turned it down. Finally, Leonard Goldenson of ABC and ABC Paramount Records explained why all the major companies had turned it down. No large corporate-owned record company could do it, because if it bombed, they all had dealings with the government. But he knew who could do it. He called Archie Blyer, who owned Cadence Records and who in a former life had been Arthur Godfrey's band leader. Blyer jumped at it, provided a $15,000 advance, and booked fine recording studios in New York City's Great Northern Hotel for October 22, 1962. Meanwhile, out in Hollywood, Warner Brothers had just released My Son the Folk Singer. In the issue of Cashbox, dated October 27th, where the album was noted in the album picks section and debuted in the number 43 position, the label also issued a full-page apology for not being able to keep up with demand for copies by distributors and stores. They even went so far as to allow the sale of copies without outer jackets, with a coupon for a jacket when available, which caused DJ Gary Owens to quip that he had an exclusive on KMPC by being the first one to air the jacket. British Warner Brothers also had to provide a jacket without the photo in color. I do have a copy of that here. The album jumped to number 21 the following week and soared to number 3 on the November 10th chart. Mind you, this was all while real folk singer Joan Baez had 3 albums in the top 20. And the number 1 album for several weeks had been Warner Brothers' own Peter, Paul, and Mary's debut album, with sales by then of 500,000. When this album topped the November 17th chart, it too had sold 500,000 copies. But that was in less than a month's time. Cashbox noted that it was selling like a single. Back in New York on October 22nd, the audience at Fine's Ballroom Studio had already been seated while the cast took a break at the bar next door. And on the TV in the bar was the real JFK giving the speech of his life, the Cuban Missile Crisis speech. Blyer was ready to toss the tape in the trash, but they did the recording anyway. The audience hadn't known about the speech. Masters were cut, the album cover was photographed, and some of the usual pressing plants Blyer used were notified, and production began. When the first few copies arrived at the Cadence office on November 12th, Bob Booker took one over to the radio station where he worked, WINS. Stan Z. Burns was going on the air in 15 minutes at 1 p.m., but quickly listened to a few cuts, grabbed the disc, and proceeded to play little else for the next 3 hours. The other jocks on the station picked up on it. And the other New York stations started clamoring for it, but for this day, that was the only copy. The fact that the First Family received enormous amounts of radio airplay seems counterintuitive to us now. Cadence even noted in its trade press advertising that top 40 radio stations broke their top 40 format to play these comedy routines. Alan Sherman getting radio play was a given. His stuff was songs. We would think that TV appearances by Meter would have been what would have sold the album. But Booker was a work, but he didn't really appear on TV until the album was released. Bob Booker was a working DJ, and from the beginning, he and Earl Dowd designed the album to be DJ-friendly. Many of the tracks were under a minute, a few were song length, and several were extra long to enable bathroom breaks. The album took off like a rocket once it got out to the stores on November 14th, but getting it out wasn't easy. Archie Bleier had lost faith in it. He had heard too many imperfections in the performance, such as audience laughs interrupting a line, and wanted to re-record at the very least. But Booker and Dowd liked those imperfections. It was like live radio. Behind Bleier's back, Cadence production manager Bob Mack had helped Booker and Dowd edit and resequence the tape, take out lines that didn't work, and then cut multiple master lacquers so it could go into production simultaneously at pressing plants across the country. And this is where my education as a record collector really started. When Life magazine published an article which is still tucked away in my original copy of the album, they mentioned that 10 pressing plants around the country are churning out copies. Aha! This explains why my cousin's copy in the Bronx had the timings for each track on the label and mine didn't. How often do you get to examine multiple copies of a record? And this is what I've been doing, amongst other things, for 50 years. I always check each copy I come across, and now have copies from all but one of those 10 pressing plants, plus Canada and the UK. And they're lined up down here, by the way. The ones I took pictures of, you'll see in a second, are the ones that are on the table. Bob Mack had placed an initial pressing order for 15,000 copies. Cadence was quickly sold out in just New York City. The East Coast plants would not be enough. Bob Mack booked the first flight he could to Los Angeles for Sunday the 18th, and his assistant Peter Hess flew to Indianapolis. Both were hand-carrying master lacquers and the all-important four-color front cover positive masters. Victor pressed 2 million copies of the first family in Rockaway, New Jersey, Indianapolis, and Hollywood. Columbia pressed 1 million copies in Bridgeport, Pittman, New Jersey, and Los Angeles. Capitol was pressing at Scranton. That's 7. The 3 smaller independent plants were Sonic in Hicksville, Long Island, Monarch in Los Angeles, and All Disc in Roselle, New Jersey. Those are the 10 that Life magazine had reported. It's nearly impossible to get viewable photographs of the entire scribed matrix numbers, but if you look at the records themselves, they're easy to identify. Each master has the record number. Beyond that, there are markings for each company. RCA assigned matrix numbers N09P 3072 and 73 to the album. N is for 1962, O is for phonograph record, 9 is custom master lacquers furnished, and P is 12-inch fine groove. 2 sets of lacquers went to each plant, and the ones that are numbered 2 have the bands between the tracks cut very wide apart. Most commonly found are RCAs. After the RCA matrix number, you will see R1 or R2 for Rockaway, New Jersey, IND1 and IND2 for Indianapolis, and there you notice the New Jersey labels did not have the timings. That's what mine is. It's an R pressing. These now, most of them will have the timings. And there is also a second version that I found for Indianapolis. One Indianapolis pressing I have has a small circle in the label area which is similar to what is seen on one side of the Sonic pressings. But all the rest on that record seem to match Indianapolis. And then you would also find ones that say H1 or H2 for Hollywood. There is also a small, tiny stamped R, I, or H, the 12 o'clock position. Now, Columbia assigned matrix number XTV86619 and 20, with the X meeting 12-inch size. Now, determining which pressing plants on Columbia is difficult, but one pressing I have has a distinctly different label printing, which is much like the RCA Hollywood printing. So these might be the Columbia Hollywood pressings. I have two pressings that have a small P after the stamped matrix number, so I think that's Pittman. And the pressings without P with identical labels being Bridgeport, Connecticut. I'd like to get a full identification of that if someone really knows Columbia pressings. Now, Capitol only used their original Scranton, PA plant. So in addition to their easily notable pressing circle in the label area and their distinctive matrix typeface, while they were still using the RCA assigned numbers, however, the discs also display the chevron as their plant indicator. There are two different label types. One uses a larger typeface for the act numbers, where it says Act 1 on Side 1 and Act 2 on Side 2. Sonic does not add another matrix number on the record or on the label, but written in small script is Sonic 1 or Sonic 2. You'll also notice on the picture the small circle around the spindle hole, and this was usually only on one side. All disc used the RCA matrix number in the original hand scribing with AD1 or AD2 after it. I'm going to have to ask you West Coasters for some help to be on the lookout for a Monarch pressing for me. I thought I had one, but oh well. Now, Canadian copies used IND1 masters, but crossed out the little stamped I. British copies on Decca's London American series had laminated covers, maroon labels, and recut masters. I also have reports of copies pressed in either Holland or Belgium with black labels using the old style cadence format. Now, stereo copies of either volume are relatively scarce, and the stereo sound is not very good on volume one anyway. Although Bob Fine was famous for stereo and then the microphone set up in the pictures looks like it was for stereo, the record seems to be in mono with occasional panning of effects or voices. It took me 10 years to find my first stereo copy. And I was looking for them from the very beginning in 1962. Stores rarely stocked comedy records in stereo in 1962. Of my five examples, four were RCA Indianapolis pressings with stamped matrix numbers, but handwritten mono matrix numbers crossed out. You could slightly see this at the 11 and 1 o'clock positions. The Rockaway, New Jersey pressing I have has hand-scribed matrix numbers, but likewise also have the mono number crossed out. And you can slightly see it at the 12 o'clock position. It's hard to do it for pictures that will be projected, but it's easy to see if you look at the records. Now, while we're at it, let me quickly go through volume two since it's fairly simple. I have only four mono and one stereo copies. But of these, Columbia seems to be the presser of choice. Here is a Columbia mono stock copy. The matrix number is up at the 12 o'clock position. Here's a Columbia promo copy. And then an RCA Indianapolis promo copy, which has stamped matrix numbers. I don't have an RCA stock copy. My stereo copy is Columbia. Canadian copies use an RCA-stamped matrix number, much like the American Indianapolis pressing. Now, the records were not just being sold in record stores. The National Association of Record Merchandisers figured that through January, 1.25 million copies had been sold on racks in supermarkets, variety, drug, discount, and department stores, and service PXs, one quarter of all the sales. And they awarded Meter and Cadence as the best-selling comedy star and comedy album of all time on racks. Alan Sherman's album came in second. It's a sad fact that a hit record can kill a record company. Bob Booker claims that Blyer and Cadence was eventually done in by the excess profits tax, although I heard claims to the contrary. Cadence did close in 1964, but I had heard that Archie just wanted to retire. Now, you remember the Cashbox reported that Warner Brothers was allowing copies of My Son the Folk Singer to be sold without jackets. But even though now Bob Booker recalls that this also happened with the First Family, Archie would not allow that to happen, knowing that if he allowed copies with substandard or no jackets, he would be opening the floodgates wide for counterfeiters. Every copy must have a legitimate jacket. Cadence had been using a unique pebbled surface paper for its covers for a number of years, and copies with this paper would be distinctive. But they did have to scale back on this slightly, and many copies were sold with standard smooth paper slicks. Examining thousands of copies over the years, most of these turn out to be RCA Indianapolis pressings with the smooth paper, although this varies because undoubtedly there are copies out there where the records have been switched. Now, I've examined thousands of copies of this album. I have never seen a counterfeit copy. But we need to explain why the presence of these two mega-selling albums was turning the Christmas selling season topsy-turvy. It was a good thing for the industry as a whole, but it wrecked the plans for many parts of it. As a high school student back then, I was still a typical record buyer. I would go into a store with plans to buy one record, maybe two, tops. And these two records often turned out to be the total sales of the store could do for most customers. Seasonal Christmas records were being ignored, if they could get pressed. Victor Columbia and Capitol took some of their own labels' albums off the presses to service the First Family. Other independent labels, which depended on these companies for their pressings, found themselves waiting at the end of the line. Performers such as Peter, Paul, and Mary found their album bumped off the top sales charts, and they maybe even lost sales to a folk song parody album on their own label. It took a while to get back to normal. These two albums were slowing down by mid to late January, themselves being bumped off the charts by Sherman's second album, My Son the Celebrity. I haven't even started to discuss all the knockoffs that started to hit the markets in late December and generally went nowhere except into the collections of fanatics like me. At home with that other family on roulette. And when roulette demands equal time, considering their mob connections, you consider it. That other family on Laurie, and I found another copy of that in Half Price Books, different pressing, as a matter of fact. My Son the President. The audacity of them saying that the million selling, it wasn't a million selling seller on Klan Records. The President Strikes Back on Cap Records, the first reasonably big label. In March, Cameo Parkway produced an album of genuine political recordings of the best of Washington humor, narrated by newscaster Chet Huntley. Culpix and Chuck McCann produced Sing Along with Jack. while Reprise sort of combined these two albums by incorporating actual speeches into songs which sing along with JFK. Strand put out their own album titled My Son the President. Heck, they put out two albums with that title. Things were starting to get loony, just in time for volume two of The First Family. Booker was finally able to drag Vaughn Meader kicking and screaming into the Columbia Recording Studios to record volume two on March 18th. He and the cast had been doing a national tour, but Meader had always said he did not want to be typecast as Kennedy and that he did much more than Kennedy in his act. In an interview published as early as December 2, 1962, he stated he wanted to get out of the Kennedy business and was looking for a romantic ballad to sing on his first Johnny Carson Tonight Show appearance. In early November 63, he recorded an album for Verve Records called Have Some Nuts and was interviewed by the AP. I'm not ungrateful for the First Family. It accomplished overnight what it would have taken me four or five more years. But I want to show I can do something else. My new album is called Have Some Nuts, and it's the funniest album ever recorded. It's a satire on such groups as the John Birch Society and the Communist Party. This article was in the early editions of the papers of November 22, 1963. Most people didn't get to read it. It confirms the irony that Meader was already moving away from the Kennedy identity. Personal friends of his in decades that followed described what a brilliant improvisationalist he was, and that his major forte both before and after that Kennedy year was improvising humorous songs at the piano. He could have been Alan Sherman if he hadn't looked and sounded like JFK even his normal voice. He reportedly had a fine singing voice. Perhaps he might have been doing Mark Russell's gig had not fate intervened. As it was, despite his other talents, he was not able to recapture an audience even for his further LPs. He immediately lost all bookings, including a spot on the first Grammy special, The Best on Record, which had been preempted from NBC on November the 24th, Sunday, after the assassination. It's been reported that Meader asked to be included in a serious tribute to JFK when the show was aired, but was turned down. He also was bumped from a full 30-minute episode of the Joey Bishop Show. On that show, it was said that he deliberately played down the JFK aspect, and he even worked in some of his song parodies into that show. And it turns out that the part of the Academy program that he was pulled out of also was not a Kennedy imitation, it was the song parodies. The assassination of President Kennedy on the Friday before Thanksgiving turned the entire country around. Comic Chuck McCann was in a TV studio rehearsing some political puppets. His hand was literally in the JFK puppet. Bob Booker was having lunch with Allen Ginsberg and Bob Dylan. Believe it or not, that's what he says. I raced back to my office on the way, making the decision we were not going to profit from the frenzied scramble for Kennedy memorabilia already afoot. I got Blyer on the phone at Cadence and suggested we withdraw and destroy every copy of both albums so as to not cash in. He agreed. The records were recalled and broken up at a depot in New Jersey that week. I have never seen a remaindered new copy of either album. I never found any copies amongst the a million cutouts at the one-stop record distributor I worked for in 66 and 67. The listing disappeared from Schwann without going through the ritual of another month with the Black Diamond. It was just gone. The other albums hung around for a while, especially those that had a tie-in with My Son, but sales and pressing figures had been small anyway. Many radio stations scrambled to put together memorial programs that weekend, and some of those proved significant for our story. Over in England, the outlandish political humor program on the BBC television, that was the week that was, scrapped their script for Saturday night and put together the most poignant 22 minutes of the weekend. NBC had been auditioning it for an American edition, and once the tape arrived in New York and converted to NTSC, they aired it Sunday at 11 p.m. and Monday at 6:45 p.m. I happened to catch it both times. The hastily written song In the Summer of His Years, sung by Millicent Martin in the telecast, was quickly recorded by Connie Francis and many others. The soundtrack of the TV program was stretched out over two sides of a 12-inch Decca LP in both mono and fake stereo, using very widely spaced grooving. 20th Century Fox gathered together excerpts of Kennedy speeches from Fox movie tone newsreel soundtracks. David Lansky formed a company with the name Documentaries Unlimited, which quickly used a memorial radio program narrated by Barry Gray. It was these recordings which Cashbox magazine deemed legitimately distributed records, including them in their new release highlights and tabulating them for the charts. But these were not the albums which turned the industry upside down. On the underbelly of the record business were cheapy labels, which were rarely sold in records in real record stores, but were more likely to be found on racks in supermarkets and drugstores. Miller International's Stereo Fidelity was one of these more acceptable labels. But others were made by companies with descriptive names like Synthetic Plastics. Ironically, at least 6 months before the assassination, Miller International put out a bargain LP with one side excerpts of FDR speeches and the other side an uncut JFK inaugural address, its first appearance on records. It was labeled as Volume 1 in a Library and Sound series, but Miller never continued with it and probably never repressed it after the assassination, because I saw it once only after that. The major album was issued by Premier Albums, headed by Philip Landwehr. Titled John Fitzgerald Kennedy, A Memorial Album, it contained the WMCA Memorial Program, narrated by Ed Brown on November 22nd. It hit the streets within a week. Priced at $1 and not going through the normal record distribution market, Premier claimed sales of upwards of 4 million copies, with 50,000 copies in Dallas alone. Considering how common this album is, especially when comparing it with all of the other documentary albums combined, these figures are believable. Pressing plants variations abound. When I pulled out my 13 copies, I found that 8 were different. In addition to retail store sales, it was also offered by mail order with large newspaper ads. This was in my original copy. While it got no industry respect in the US, it did in England, and was issued by English Decca on its budget Ace of Clubs label in a fine English pressing. Many of the American supermarket labels followed Premier's example, the first and largest being Synthetic Plastics on Diplomat and Pickwick. These went international, and this one even went international because there's the American pressing and there's the Canadian pressing. And there were also many local issues of radio compilations across the country. Memphis, Philadelphia, and many others. The competitive fallout began when Premier got a temporary restraining order in California Superior Court against Crown, Cadet, and Topps Records, and Crown's affiliate, United Superior, for selling such similar records that they felt customers were thinking they were buying premieres. In January, Culpix issued the most important record album of our time, 4 Days That Shocked the World. And RCA Victor issued NBC's year-ender, A Time to Keep, 1963. And time today is short, and I've really only told a quarter of the story. And we will do a longer version at ARSC New York. Many other JFK documentaries and box sets followed in the coming years. As the country settled down, political comedy records abounded with dozens about LBJ, Nixon, Carter, Bush, and everybody else. But never again did they have this impact. Alan Sherman continued to record for a few years until his premature death, having a huge hit for which he is most remembered for by the younger generation, Hello Mother, Hello Father. But his albums never had the sales impact the first one did. CDs and downloads are available, and he was the subject of an expensive limited edition box set, My Son the Box. And 2 days ago, a biography of him was published. I haven't had a chance to see yet. Now we need a biography of Vaughn Meter. The first two First Family albums inspired later versions for later presidents and even governors, and were reissued at least once on LP. And after a collectible CD, they are now available on a 3-disc 50th anniversary set with a long essay by Bob Booker and some extras, including the audio of the Celebrity Talent Scouts program and a 30-minute BBC documentary. But I like the way the originals look on a shelf. These three huge runaway hits were faster selling than any album before in history, and in content were outside of the norm that would be expected for any season, let alone Christmas season. Oh, and by the way, before the record business had a chance to settle down to normal, something else happened. You know, January 1964, February 1964, look out, America, the British are coming. Do we have time for questions or?
No, I'm afraid not. But I'm sure everybody can ask questions tonight. Everybody
I'm fighting for records at the record sale.
It's better than fighting over barbecue. Okay.